It's time again for Health Talk on KFAR Radio. 30 minutes of healthy conversation about practical ways to improve your quality of life. Now, from the all-new White Spruce Medical, here's your host, Dr. Scott Looper.
Good afternoon, Fairbanks. Welcome to Health Talk. My name is Dr. Scott Looper, and I'm your host today as we talk about health, how to get it, and how to keep it. With me today is Mike Powers. Mike was the CEO of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and Denali Center for 20 years. 10 years prior to that, you were the chief financial officer.
That's correct.
Let me just say, you're steeped in the hospital administration about as much as a person can be. Mike is now retired, recently retired, and he has asked to interview me on the show. We've never done this in 13 years. So, Mike, I'm very intrigued on what we're going to do today. Anyways, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you to ask your questions.
Okay. Well, thank you, Scott. I've known you 15 years, not closely know of you and how naturopathic medicine came to Fairbanks. You introduced the discipline, many respects, and I've seen things change, and I've seen more and more friends interested, adopting this discipline as a way to stay healthy. So, and I know over the years we've maybe bumped heads a little bit over access to different services, and I'd like to talk about that as well. Mm-hmm.
Wanted stuff that you had.
That's correct.
Pure and simple.
That's right.
That is so I can help my patients, so I can order tests and diagnostic images and things like that. And the hospital has been somewhat reluctant in doing the things I want.
Sure. And just to hear the other side, since 1972, we've had contracts in place with various disciplines when it was hard to attract physicians to Fairbanks, and so we honored those. But there's always room for give and take, and I think it's probably time for a little bit more give and take.
But, boy, I sure like that.
Question for you, though. Just the whole discipline of naturopathic medicine, just tell me a little bit about the origins of...
Okay. So the origins of naturopathic medicine are vague. It's not like it was invented all in one go. It's been, as long as people have been scratching their heads and trying to figure out why people are sick, the spirit of naturopathic medicine has been manifest. Now, having said that, there was this guy, Vincent Presnitz. He was a farmer back in the 1700s in Germany, and he discovered that his horses got better. They were sick and they got diseases. They got better by taking baths in his local pond. And he got interested in using cold water and warm water in various applications to improve people. Practice on his family, practice on his neighbors, practice on the villagers, practice on enough people that eventually he was practicing on the king, no exaggeration. Okay. He got a reputation for being able to cure things that no one else could cure. And he was a practical farmer. He was just a practical-minded guy. And he did these treatments to stimulate circulation. And if you can increase blood flow, a lot of times people will heal from the inside.
How does the discipline make the jump across the ocean to the U.S.?
So there was a guy, he was a priest by the name of Father Knipe, and Father Knipe studied hydrotherapy. That was the main thing that he did. And he popularized it in Europe. So there was this whole spa, thing that people were doing. They were opening spas, and especially rich people. They would fly to the city, and they would drink the waters and get massages and different hydrotherapy treatments and so on and so forth. And he was very systematic about it, and he impressed doctors here in the United States. And so they went and studied with him.
In roughly what year?
Was in the 1800s, late 1800s.
Okay.
Early 20th century.
Okay.
And then there was one guy, Lindahl, forget his first name, but anyways, he had a bent towards science. He was very interested in scientifically running tests and figuring out what was actually going on with people. And he's the father of the scientific bent towards naturopathic medicine.
Okay.
And that is absolutely what I do. I have an interest in the reality and the science behind why people get sick and why they don't get sick.
Now, to get personal and make this jump, where are you from and how did you learn about this? What drove you to head down the naturopathic?
It's an excellent question. I'm from, born in California, but grew up in Oregon, near Portland, in a little town called Westland, part of the little area of Willamette. Anyways, more information than you need. But there is a strong tradition of naturopathic medicine in the area that I grew up, of which I was totally unaware of. I never knew a naturopathic doctor at all until my wife got pregnant and I took a baby class, and one of the presenters at the baby class was a local naturopathic doctor. And so I thought, oh, how interesting. There's this thing called naturopathy. I really didn't know anything about it. At the time, I was a school teacher and I was making $17,000 a year, working 60 hours a week. Gotcha. And I was just thinking, you know, I think I could do better than this. And so I sat at a Chinese restaurant with my wife, and I said, we were talking about the future, and I said, you know what, I'd really like to be a doctor, but I already passed that turn in the road. I'm now down the teacher pathway. She said, au contraire, in 4 years, if you start being a doctor, you're going to be a doctor. In 4 years, you're going to be 4 years older and not a doctor. It depends on what you decide today, right now. And then being a Chinese restaurant, I got a fortune cookie that said, you'll soon get a new career. I took that as an auspicious sign.
That's great.
Anyway, so I figured I'd just be an MD. There's a big medical school in Portland.
Sure.
And I applied. I didn't apply for it, but I asked for information from them. I got a brochure, talked to people, and, you know, talked about the service aspect of medicine and you know, working with different people, different walks of life, and so on and so forth. And then having heard about this naturopathic medicine thing, I sent away for a brochure from the Naturopathic College, and the brochure came back and said, the tenets of naturopathic medicine, the principles of naturopathic medicine are things like first do no harm, a doctor is teacher, find the cause of the problem, a series of these things.
Okay.
Funny thing is I read this brochure, and I knew to the marrow of my bones, this is what I wanted to do.
How did you find your school and... It's a four-year program?
No, wait. Let me give you the rest of the story. Okay. The rest of the story is I was embarrassed that I was going to make this life-changing decision to become a naturopathic doctor, and I didn't know diddly about naturopathic doctor. I never visited one. I never went to the college. And so I just told no one, not my wife, not anybody. And instead, I went through this whole elaborate charade of making it look like I was a reasonable person. I interviewed all these people. I talked to the college. I visited them, talked to patients, talked to doctors. After a month of doing this, I thought, well, it looks pretty reasonable. And so I decided I made the announcement. I want to be a naturopathic doctor. 3 years later, I was preceptoring with a local brilliant physician. And somehow or other, I got off into the story, and we were in between patients, and I told him the story I just told you. And he looked at me with a quizzical look on his face, and he says, how often do you make decisions based on too little information? And I said, hardly ever. Really, I'm not that guy. And I thought, maybe four, five maybe? He said, uh-huh. And of these four or five maybe decisions, how many of them were accurate? And I thought, all of them. He says, well, this is God's way of compensating for you being retarded. It's a gift horse. Don't. that's what I've learned. I learned to trust that little part of me that knows. It doesn't come up very often, but when it does, I listen to it. That's what got me into naturopathic medicine.
Okay, so access, barriers, and where you are now. So what naturopathic school, what were the barriers, and then how and when did you make the jump to Fairbanks?
So the naturopathic school is the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. Now it's a National University of Natural Medicine. They've grown. They have a lot more programs. And the whole profession has grown a lot. I ended up moving to Arizona. Long story short, I got a job as the guy who runs second year in medical school. That's what I did. I was the chairman of diagnostics. In second year medical school is when you learn to be a doctor. You learn how to do physical exams. You learn how to do differential diagnosis. You learn how to run lab tests. I always had a bent for that kind of stuff. And with my teaching background, it gave me a leg up to be able to know how to teach. And so I not only taught these classes myself, mostly what I did is I managed other people who were teaching the classes. Eventually, I became chief medical officer at the teaching clinic. And I was kind of fast-tracking to become the president. But here's the rub. I spend all my time running meetings. Now, for those of you who run meetings, mm-hmm. I am so appreciative of your mm-hmm. skills and talents. You're one of those people, by the way. It's a fabulous thing to be able to do. It was harder for me to work on that level. I'm a more of a sit across from somebody, get into the nitty-gritty of their problem, and fix it kind of person, and I missed that. So after several years of being an administrator, I quit it all, moved to Alaska, bought a local clinic, and started treating patients.
Okay.
And I was 10 times happier.
So, got it. Made the jump. You're here practicing. Tell me about your patients and the profile of the patients, and who are you seeing? And are you seeing the entire continuum from pediatrics to geriatrics? What's going on in the clinic any given day?
Yeah, so what I do is I treat the people who show up. I'll treat pretty much anybody with anything. And it's a steep position to take, but I have a knack for figuring out what's going on with people. I have a knack for asking good questions. And I don't sound like an egomaniac. I'm not. I'm just frankly letting you know what I'm good at. And I also have a very strong knack of knowing what kind of lab tests to run to confirm my suspicions. And so I treat, by and large, what my practice has boiled down to is treating people that are not easily treated. Many times folks will go and they have a problem and they'll go and see a doctor and the doctor will diagnose them and put them on whatever the typical treatment for it is, and it doesn't work. And so they, you know, suffer whatever, and usually a friend or a neighbor or somebody they know will say, have you ever seen Dr. Looper? He's usually pretty good at figuring this kind of stuff out. And then they show up. And that's really my bread and butter.
Okay.
It's working with most people.
Okay. Clarification, you are not an egomaniac, and that is what I have learned over the last 15 years and why I'm so intrigued with what you have brought to Fairbanks, what you continue to bring. And getting back to the question a little bit earlier, as you look at the patients you saw today, who did you see 20 years ago, and who are you seeing today? How have those diagnoses changed?
Not at all.
Is that right?
They're the same.
How about psych issues or behavioral health
issues? I was always seeing psych issues, and I still see psych issues. I had a psych patient today. I have a patient. The last patient I saw today, I have to be careful. I have the HIPAA, and I can't say too much.
Yep.
But she is a patient from the East Coast. Anyways, long story. So I do these Zoom visits, remote telemedicine things occasionally. And she... when COVID came, she locked herself into her apartment for about 2 years, and it didn't suit her. She ended up really going downhill. She's a patient with chronic fatigue, and she has a complicated genetic situation. She has a condition known as Ehlers-Danlos condition. It's a connective tissue mutation. It doesn't make connective tissues correctly, so she doesn't hang together right. She's easily injured, and it affects her sleep. It affects her immune system. Things don't work right. Mm-hmm. And so she absolutely was depressed and contemplating different ways of killing herself. Just could hardly stop her. And she's a sensible, reasonable, intelligent person who's doing the best she can, trying to be a good citizen, trying to be conscientious and not spread COVID, had bought in to doing the right thing. And it came at an incredible personal cost. So she has made it. When I talk to her, there's a lot of technical stuff that I'll talk to her about, a lot of specific aspects of her condition that we're compensating for with various treatments. But the big picture thing was, you got to get out of the house.
Gotcha.
And she was deathly afraid of catching COVID. And I said, why are you afraid of COVID? Well, because COVID might kill me. I said, what's going to get you first, your suicide or the COVID? I mean, the COVID, you got a chance, right? A 3-4%, 2% chance maybe of dying from COVID. The chance of dying from suicide is a lot higher than that. And she said, you know, I never thought of it that way.
So Scott, and we talked about this, your interest in figuring things out, and that's ultimately what drove you to this particular discipline. Let me go back to an earlier question.
Wait. If I wasn't a doctor, I would be a repairman. Because it's the same consciousness. Another patient I saw today is a guy who knows how to fix stuff. I looked him in the eye and I said, you and I are the same. We have a different profession, but we think the same.
Very good.
And I'm going to let you, I'm going to give you some ideas about what's going on with you, and you and I are going to lean in together to solve your problem, right?
It's very good.
Okay.
Yeah. The question I had asked earlier is, you know, what was different 20 years ago than today? You said nothing. Now, one thing you did mention are delivery systems, Zoom, the virtual world we're in. How much are you doing that? And
Not much. I'd say one or two patients a week I'll do as Zoom or phone. I much prefer doing patients face to face. I get much more information. I feel it more. I lean in more. I can do physical exam.
Gotcha.
I can see how people squirm. You know, if it's Zoom, you get a fair amount of information, but there's something about being across from somebody. And I have egomaniac thing. I have a knack for reading people's body language and knowing if I'm on the right track or not.
Okay.
And I could see that in person easier than I can on Zoom.
You may not be using this technology, but here in far-flung Alaska, it is probably a very valuable.
Without a doubt. And, you know, the research shows that it works.
Uh-huh.
It's just, a lot of times it's like, well, it's kind of a second-class medicine, and it really doesn't work. No. There's a lady I know down in Anchorage that did a very good study on the delivery of psychological medicine, counseling, and measured the outcomes. And she was sure the outcomes are going to be worse with telemedicine, and they weren't.
Isn't that something?
They were actually slightly better. There's something about having that little distance that makes people a little more comfortable. And so it really does work.
Another question, you're triggering a number of them. Who is a difficult patient? What do you like to see as a patient comes in? What honest feedback? What information? What do you like to see?
Yeah, let me do the opposite of that one. Who's a good patient? A good patient is a patient who cares. A patient who's willing to think. A patient who's willing to lean in and actually cares about their condition. They don't have a preconceived notion about how this is supposed to go. What they do is they have an open mind and a willingness to engage. So I do way, way better medicine if I get buy-in. And I'm using a lot of fancy words. Let me make it even simpler. A patient who trusts me, that's who I do work with.
And how does a patient build trust with you and you build trust with the patient?
I don't know. I think what you do is you take a leap of faith. And if we're going to wait till we know each other for a year, we're going to spin our wheels for a long time. There's a sincerity that I have because I really do care. I mean, actually, for real, care. And I like fixing things. And I'm real blunt about this. If somebody comes in and they get better, I feel like my life has meaning and purpose. So I lean in myself because I like it. And it's like they're willing to trust me and do some things that I'm asking them to do and give it a go. And then we've got a chance of actually doing something that works. Now, this is too theoretical. Let me give you a practical example. There's a patient who I saw earlier today who had a series of sinus infections. And so I told her, here's what I want you to do. I want you to do this thing called nasal lavage. I want you to get a bowl, put a cup of warm water in it, put a teaspoon of salt, stir it around till the salt's dissolved, then tip your head forward, cup the water, and snort it up your nose.
Yep.
Now, it takes a certain amount of trust for someone to do that. You know, people sit in my chair and they'll nod like they're going to do it. And when I first told people to do this, I had 1 in 3 would actually do it. Now that I there's a way I could say it better, I can get 2 out of 3 to do it because it goes against common sense.
Sure,
who in their
sure.
right mind is going to snort up salt water in their nose? First of all, it's going to burn.
Right.
I got nose water in my nose when I was in the swimming pool, and it hurt.
Sure.
I don't want to do that. See, we all know what it feels like, except for it doesn't. It doesn't burn. That's what the salt ratio is all about, making it to where it doesn't burn. And it doesn't hurt, and it's weird, but you don't drown, you don't inhale the water, and it is the most incredibly effective treatment to open up your sinuses and drain them, bar none, best thing ever. They've invented all these machines to do it. Nothing works as well as cupping the salt water and snorting it up your nose because it sends the salt water in a swirl pattern. It goes where I want it to go instead of you having to take some kind of bulb syringe or water pick or something like that. It just literally goes where I want it to go. It swirls in the correct pattern and is literally more effective.
Fascinating. Fixing things. Okay, so patient comes in, you're obviously reading their behavior, you're asking questions, you mentioned labs. How are you? What tools are you using in order to understand the issue?
Anything and everything I can. In whatever I can. Whatever I can think of and get them to do, that's what I'm doing. Occasionally it's an MRI. In spite of the resistance of getting MRIs done at the hospital, we found a workaround. Okay. Northstar does MRIs for us.
Okay.
Not that I use them that often. They're expensive, and mostly they're overkill. The bread and butter of what I do is a regular lab test. I've used LabCorp, and we do blood tests and look at a regular blood screening. We add a few add-ons that the normal doctors don't add on. I do an extra liver enzyme called a GGT.
Okay.
I'll do an inflammatory marker called a C-reactive protein because I want to see what inflammation is going on. A lot of my patients are inflamed. I'll do a SED rate. For the same reason, it measures inflammation, but in a different way. And then I'm prone to do kind of weird, obscure tests that nobody's even heard of because they're very helpful. I'll give an example. There's a test I run called a MMP9, and it measures cytokine activation as a whole. That's a useful thing. Now, we know about cytokines from COVID.
Okay, I don't. If you can.
Well, cytokines are mostly inflammatory molecules that the immune system releases in response to infection or some kind of tissue damage. Not all of them are inflammatory. A few of them are non-inflammatory. There's about 100 of them. And I don't want to run 100 things. It's too many. So the MMP9 is a molecule. Now, bear with me because this is going to sound weird. It's a molecule that drills a hole in your blood vessel lining. And that through that hole, the cytokines go in and out. Now, they can't do their job unless they got a hole. So in order for the cytokines to work, the MMP9 has to be upregulated so you can get a sense what the whole kit and caboodle of the cytokines are doing, whether they're active or not, based on the MMP9. What a great test, right? Okay. But hardly anybody knows this.
Okay.
And I learned it from a colleague who practices on the East Coast. But another interesting story, to be half hour for me to tell you the whole thing. But anyways, I get it from wherever I can. It's been very, very, very helpful at cracking open cases. Remember the lady I told you about earlier, the one on the East Coast, was trapped in with COVID? MMP9 was one of the key tests that helped me to figure out what was going on with her.
Getting information wherever you can. What are the conferences that you attend? I'm trying to figure out your continuing medical education. How are you staying abreast of latest developments?
Well, mostly conferences, I love conferences. They're really good. It's funny, conferences are kind of going away. They're not what they used to be. They're poorly attended. COVID drove people away from congregating. So I still love them. I'm one of those hardcore, old-fashioned people that go to conferences. So there's several naturopathic conferences every year. There's a national conference. There's a Northwest conference. There are specialty conferences. There's a cancer conference. There's a gastrointestinal conference. And then I'll also go to whatever interesting conferences there are. If word on the street, there's something that's going on. There's a longevity organization. It's mostly MDs and DOs, but they have interesting stuff there. And I've attended their conference 3 times. There's another national cancer conference that does kind of alternative medicine stuff. I've attended their conference 3 times and learned just tons. It's very, very, very helpful. And I'll take it wherever I can. The problem is, it's not availability of conferences really. The main problem is availability of time. Because if I'm having to take time out of my practice, that's rough. So I try to hit 2 conferences a year, maybe 3 if I'm particularly ambitious. And lately, even though I like to do these ones in person, I've been doing more of the online conferences. I've actually attended several of those.
Okay. 3 big worries. Opioids, the whole aging issue, and then maybe complementary to that, the whole dementia issue. Can you comment on what you're seeing or what you're concerned about on the opioid crisis here locally and then in generally across?
Mike, those are excellent questions because they really are crisis in healthcare. The opioid is the problem with that one is people are in pain. And what people in pain do is they try to find ways to knock the pain down. And opiates are, narcotics are extremely effective at that in a way at first. Later on, they don't work so good. But at first, they work really, really well. They're a godsend. They're a fabulous thing to do. Unfortunately, they're addictive, and they set up this pattern where nobody gets better. What it is, you get in a stable, dysfunctional pattern, and then if you're unlucky, you'll overdose on them and die. So there's that as well. So the main problem here is people desperate for solutions. Mm-hmm. So what I do with people who are in opiates is if they come to me, and they do occasionally, not for opiates because I don't prescribe and I wouldn't anyways, mm-hmm. what I do is I'll start asking questions and running tests and try to figure out what's going on with them and try to get to the bottom of things. Now, opiate patients are particularly difficult. They're slow to heal. I don't know exactly why. Something about the opiates slow everything down, and it's a hard case to turn. Not to say it can't be turned, it just runs slower. Okay, that's enough said about that one. The next one is aging and dementia. I'll throw those together. Okay. The thing about aging is so often people say, I'm old. That's why I don't work. My problem is because I'm old. And it's not. It's not. That is not your problem. The problem is something broke. It took a while. It took a while to show up. So now you're older and you can see that problem. But it's not because you're older. It's because something broke along the way. What we need to do is figure out what that is, fix it, and you're going to be better. Now, eventually we wear out. We're programmed that way. Human beings don't last forever. Literally, we're programmed that way. It's part of our nature. There's reasons for that, and I'm going to do another show on what aging is and why and how it helps our society as a whole. And there's a bunch of benefits to having the old ones die and the new ones come up. I just let you know there's a benefit. It doesn't feel that way when you're old. I don't see any benefit here. Nonetheless, if it's broken, you can fix it. I had a B210, a Datsun B210 that the clutch went out, and I didn't say, oh, woe is me, my car is old, so now I can't climb hills anymore, I just have to ease down the road. No, I went and got a new clutch, and my car was great. Now, it didn't last forever, but it ran a lot better, and I could climb hills and everything. That's it. That's how to see aging, like that. You want to lean in and fix things as they come up as best you can.
Scott, how's our time?
Oh, we got about 5 minutes.
Okay. When does forgetfulness become something to really worry about?
It's when it's debilitating, when you can't function normally. I mean, I forget stuff, too. You've seen me struggle for names tonight. It happens to all of us. And, you know, I work around. I write stuff down. And all of us have you know, our systems get a little creaky as we go. We do what we can to help them. And then I could do another show on how to help with memory. We talked about mm-hmm. doing a lecture up at the university. I've done it before. I could do an update on it. Okay, anyways, there's that. But eventually it gets to the point where you're debilitated, where you literally can't remember things that are important to you. You quit paying bills.
Right? Right.
Things
right.
like that.
Okay.
You can't remember how to get somewhere that you need to get to, okay. like the gas station or the grocery store. Now you're in another world.
Okay.
Now your survival is being impacted by this problem.
So what happens then? Patient comes to you, explains they're having problems remembering days of the week or something, you know, fairly significant, dramatic.
So there's a test we do. It's called a mini mental exam. And I'll take them through that and I'll ask them these questions from the mini mental exam. And you get a score out of it. And 30 is the best score that you can get. And if they're running in the 20s, I know we got something to work with. They're running in the teens, that they're in that danger zone for sure. So what we do, and I've already answered this question, I look for things that are broken. I think of everything I can to test. Okay. And part of the question that I'm going through, let me give you an example. I had a patient come see me recently who's got a memory breakdown. Her son brought her in. And so I asked her a whole bunch of questions. One of those questions was, how well do you sleep? Very poorly. So you have a hard time falling asleep or you have a hard time staying asleep? Both. Bingo.
Okay.
There's her problem. Turns out, your brain needs sleep in order to clean itself. There's these little channels that open up in your brain, and your body sends fluid running through them, and it basically your brain gets hosed down. Without that, it doesn't work right. It begins to break down. So she wasn't sleeping well enough. Now, there's another part of her. She wasn't sleeping well enough because her stress levels were very high. There's a lot of stuff she was worried about. And so the stress chemicals themselves are damaging to our brain. Damaging maybe is not the right word. What the stress chemicals do is it trims our brain down to the essentials. So you remember essential things pretty well. You just can't remember where your car keys are. You can't remember the name of your third grade teacher anymore. You can't remember, I mean, some important stuff as well. Yep. It's a hippocampal damage is what it is. Hippocampus is damaged by the stress chemicals. But here's the thing. Well, for a long time, we thought this couldn't be fixed. But then research showed us that it can be fixed. You can reconnect these connections, these neural connections, axonal connections, dendrite connections in the brain to where your brain can work better. And the research has been done on what actually helps the most. And it's not going to be a surprise to you to find out what it is. It's exercise.
Okay.
Exercise helps the most. And not only that, but they broke it down to different kinds of exercise. It turns out exercise that has a spatial aspect to it, because our memory is mostly there so we can remember where stuff is. Our ancient ancestors, our hunter and gatherer ancestors, needed to know where the animals were, needed to know where the berries and the roots were. So we have a spatial memory. So if you want to enhance your memory, you start doing things in space. Now, you could walk the neighborhood. That's one thing to do. But the best thing, far and away, head and shoulders above everything else, you want to venture a guess?
Walk.
No. No. Dance.
Okay. Okay.
Dance. Because you got somebody you're dancing with. You got to remember the dance steps. You got to maneuver through the dance floor. It's brain therapy on steroids.
Okay. I know we're probably close. Corollary, you and your music. So you play the drums. You only picked them up a year ago.
A year and a half ago. I'd been banging on drums for a while. I play bass in a band for about 10 years. But we lost our drummer, which was a calamity. And then I had to drum because we needed somebody. And I've taken to it. Let me just say, it's super fun. What a fun thing to do. You get to create rhythms with a bunch of wonderful people, and it's been a delight.
I saw you at the university's Here Comes the Sun concert 2 weeks ago. It was fantastic. The social, what is it, social club?
It's the South Cushman Social Club.
great band.
Which is well named. Mike, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a very pleasurable and interesting experience for me. I've never done this before, not even close. I mean, to spend the whole half hour talking about myself, it's so weird. Anyways, I really appreciate you doing this.
I appreciate what you brought to Fairbanks, Scott.
Thanks. I'll let everybody know this has been Health Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Scott Looper, Medical Director of White Spruce Medical, located at the Stees Medical Center here in Fairbanks, where we treat a wide variety of conditions, including diarrhea, constipation, gastritis, all kinds of stuff. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay in touch.
You've been listening to Health Talk on KFAR Radio, brought to you by White Spruce Medical in the Stees Medical Center. To listen back to this or any past programs, simply log on to KFARradio.com and go to the archives page for more Health Talk. Local stories, local programs, local news, local talk radio. We are KFAR.